I can remember there was a visitor in Mac's office one day. Can't think of his name now, but he was from Sperry Gyroscope. And Mac was showing him this, and he bounced it on the floor and said, what the hell? What's it good for? And Mac said, well, I tell you what it's good for. It's good to draw it out like this, roll it up, and bounce it on the floor. It's good to make people say, what the hell is it good for? So that was it. That was about all that we did with it. Well, of course,
You did apply for a patent.
Yes, we have a patent on it, and it's long since expired, but we applied for a patent on it, and the company apparently gave out samples to various salesmen, and one salesman managed to show it to this chap with an enterprising idea of putting it inside of an egg and selling it. He must be a millionaire. Well over.
Do you know where the name Silly Putty originated?
I think he did it. Yes, we called it Bouncing Putty, but he called it Silly Putty.
And I also came across the term Rheopexy. Did you? Is that a standard rubber term, or did you?
No, that's a rubber term for things that behave like that. That behave like solids on sharp blows, but. Like fluids on long-term pressure.
All during this period, were you aware of what GE was doing?
To some extent. Now, near the end of the war, we were thrown into interference with General Electric Company, and we had to give testimony at our local lawyer, a deposition in front of a GE lawyer on various things, and Frank Hyde did the same thing, and I'm sure things went on at General Electric. The upshot of the whole thing was, though, that the two companies decided that we had so many patents that were overlapping or that were in fields of each other's that neither one would be able to operate without license from the other. So there was a general agreement made that we would license them and they would license us over the first, I don't know how long it was a 4 or 5 year period over which those patents up to that point would be licensed to each company. And from that point on, we would go on our own ways. So we did know what they did. I went to the Gibson Island conference in the summer of 40. I should know that date.
I have here 1945.
I think it was 45, yes. And Rockow was there, and he gave a talk and showed and actually demonstrated passing methyl chloride over heated silica and getting out methyl silicon chlorides out the other end. I gave a talk which talked about cyclics and linears in the dimethyl system, and Dr. Bass gave a talk on the general field of silicones, and Dr. Hyde gave a talk. So there were the three of us there from Dow Corning. And that was the first we had known of Rockow's work on the so-called direct process. So it was shortly thereafter that we were thrown into interference, and we were fortunately able to license that work and go back and forth. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we might have had trouble.
In 1948, Hyde developed controlled alkaline polymerization of cyclics, and you worked on acid type.
Right. We worked on sulfuric acid type polymerizations. Dr. McGregor did some of the early work, and then I did some subsequent work. And I worked with fuming acid, where we could take cyclics. And we were intrigued with the idea that we had seen these other demonstrations of very rapid polymerizations that you could stir it once and pick it up. Well, it's possible to do that with a silicone, but it takes fuming sulfuric acid and so on. An interesting story along that line was, at one of these early research conferences, McGregor was demonstrating his sulfuric acid polymerization, and he added the acid and stirred and stirred and stirred, and it just never got any thicker. What had happened was that Dr. Bass had added a little of tri-substituted material so that it end-blocked it, and it wouldn't go any higher. That was the end of it. So we said, no more. If we ever go to demonstrate anything, we're going to bring all our own stuff. So when I went to demonstrate this acid polymerization, high-speed one, I brought up little vials of fuming sulfuric acid and a vial of water and everything else. So we went out on the driveway outside and nicked the tube and broke it so that we could come in and make the test afterwards. And we demonstrated that we could make a 5-second polymerization of a 200 fluid. The acid polymerization has been used because it turns out to be desirable in certain polymers, especially in those that are useful in defoaming. The polymers that are used in food defoaming and Antifoam A that we sell, which is a defoamer for, it's also organic defoaming. It'll defoam what was originally designed for removal of a monomer from a polymer, because in DuPont found that it worked, and we thought they didn't know what they were doing, and so we sent them a whole slew of things plus a little bit of the same old sample and under a different number, and the only one that worked was the old stuff. So we finally figured out they knew what they were talking about. Well, we didn't really know what it was about that polymer, but later it developed that it was traces of the acid left in this that made the thing work. So we eventually used acid polymerization as well as alkali polymerization. Alkali polymerization is used in the plant largely for rubber now, but there are some cases where you do use acid polymerization.
From 1950 on, it was primarily a study of the basic properties of the polymers.
Yes, I did an awful lot of work on the fundamentals of rubber. We managed to get a machine which was like a small Instron before the Instrons were really developed, and we measured stress under various conditions, and I started to make measurements of crystallinity in silicone rubber, because I was fascinated by one thing. On this machine, I cooled a sample down after it had been stretched. In ordinary rubber, when you cool a sample down and you start to crystallize, the stress drops off. In our rubber, when you came down and it starts to crystallize, the stress went back up. Mm. And boy, that had me confused for quite a long time. But it turned out to be true. So then we went downstairs to the people at Mellon who were in the X-ray department and had them measure some X-ray measurements of crystallinity. And then we did some dielectric measurements of density as well. And all of this was done with the idea that we'd try and check these various measurements against the same point. And it surely worked out that way. As a result, we have a couple of papers in the Journal of Polymer Science on crystallinity in our rubber. No one has ever challenged the fact that it rises, because I think we demonstrated it quite effectively.
You made the statement that the technology of a new field almost always precedes the science, not as we're accustomed to think of it as research and development.
That's right, and that startled me, but you know, even Goodyear knew how to vulcanize his rubber before he knew what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
We knew a lot about our rubber before we developed the technology or the science of the rubber and the crystallinity and all the rest of it. A lot was done and known before you got down to the fine point. I think I said something else about the fact that the time interval between the technology and the science gets shorter. Time from Goodyear till science of rubber was 60 years or so. In our case, it was about 5 or 6 years at the most. So I think things are moving faster. It may be that science and the technology are moving together more closely today.
I also wanted to ask your comments about McGregor. You worked very closely with him for a long period of time.
He was a fine boss. He was ideal boss in the sense that he encouraged you to do everything you could, and he didn't criticize or he didn't hold you back from doing anything. In fact, John Spire and I talk about it, and he's been our favorite boss, no question about that, because he did keep an open mind, and whatever you felt you had to do, you had to do. And so I can only recall one time when he was a little upset with me. It was June 22nd of 1944. A group from Corning and a group from Midland were coming to Mellon to talk about rubber. And we all knew this. It was all scheduled for that morning. And so everybody assembled, and they were all there except me. And I walked in at 10 o'clock, and boy, I could just see Max's hair rising. Here I walk in at 10 o'clock on a meeting that started at 8, and he wanted to know where I was. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but I had to attend my wife. She gave birth to our first child. Oh, well, all was forgiven.
After you started the silicone work, did McGregor do anything else, or was all his efforts directed towards silicone?
We were all working on silicones, yes. No. Mac did an awful lot of contact work outside the lab, too. He knew this fellow at Gulf that worked on the defoaming. He knew the people at Westinghouse, so that there was a lot of outside contact work that he did, and he did some traveling too to various places to talk about silicones and show samples and get cooperative work. One of the very early things, Corning put in the pilot plant basically so we could enter into work with people. Mine Safety Appliance in Pittsburgh wanted a lubricant for an oxygen compressor. Well, we knew that that was a pretty dangerous operation. So we took some of our fluid and put it on a piece of glass cloth, put it in a big bomb, and stood back and locked it up. Put a gauge on it, measured the pressure, and we took that bomb up to 200 degrees centigrade with pure oxygen in the bomb. and pressure didn't change. I mean, it just went up and stayed there. And so we drained the gas off through a beaker of barium hydroxide so that if any oxidation had occurred, we'd measure the CO2. There wasn't any. So we took it out and looked at it, and sure enough, the fluid was still there and intact, no problem. So we assumed it was all right. So for a time, we did sell some gallons of fluid to mine safety, and they used it in the pump. It worked all right. The only reason they dropped the whole project was that our dimethyl fluid is not a good lubricant, and it eroded the pumps. The pumps wouldn't work well after a while, because if anything, our 200 fluid is an anti-lubricant. It's a material that wears, and you have to have additives to keep it from wearing, or you have to build in different compositions. So that was one of the very earliest applications we worked on, was high-pressure oxygen pumps.
You then came to Dow Corning in 1956. I guess McGregor, yes, you said, came the year
before. He came the year before, and he more or less immediately started to answer inquiries that had been coming in from doctors and surgeons all over the world about, could you do this with a silicone? Could he apply this and so on? One of the first applications that was successful was a so-called hydrocephalus valve, a Holter valve. And that, all that is a small piece of silicone rubber tubing with a stainless steel valve. And it was worked on by a man by the name of Holter, whose daughter had hydrocephalus. The surgeons installed it in the back of the neck, and the one tube goes up to the brain and the other tube goes down into the abdominal cavity, and the fluid is drained off, and it saves the life of the child, and it's left in. It's just left in for the life of the child. I don't know how many have been installed. The last I heard was well over 600,000 of those.
My goodness.
So McGregor started answering this correspondence, and in time, by 1959, they formed the so-called Center for the Aid to Medical Research, which had a formal publication and worked with doctors and surgeons all over the world. And Mac did an awful lot of work in that field, until he himself got Parkinson's disease. And he died in 65, but in the last few years he was in pretty bad shape.
Was he responsible for your coming out, or was
yes,
the company?
Well, I think we talked about coming out with Dr. Bass in 55, but we decided to do it in phases, and I stayed on at Mellon to run the fellowship for a time, and then after I came out, I was the liaison back with the fellowship at Mellon, and I came out here as assistant director of research and had a small group of four men working on polymer work and mostly radiation chemistry at that time. And
were you still doing lab work yourself during that period?
No. By that time, I had been getting to the point where I was doing mostly library work and directing the work of the others, mm-hmm, writing reports and that sort of thing. I'd been the same at Mellon, too. I'd had a number of people working with me, and they did their work. We had a number of people come from here. That was interesting, too. young people who maybe wanted to finish up even a bachelor's degree came down to work with us for a few years at Mellon and finished up their degree at University of Pittsburgh. Shaler Bass even sent two of his sons, Dolph Bass and Harlan Bass, and they were with us for a year and a half or so each, and then came back. Another one, Forrest Stark, came down from here and worked with us for a time, and he then went to Penn State because we at that time had worked with Leo Summers at Penn State and had fellowships with him, so that we sent people to Penn State to get their PhD. And I would say 1, 2, 3, 4 that I know of got their PhDs at Penn State under Leo, under our sponsorship, and then came back to Dow Corning.
Were there any particular co-workers that I had one name? Was it John Goodwin?
John Goodwin was the man who ran our pilot plant in Mellon, and then he came up here fairly early on, and he worked in research up here on, he did some work on actually organic alkyd resins. It was the time at which these alkyd resins using aromatic acids, dibasic acids, were pretty popular, and he was able to show that they were pretty good. He tried to interest the company in working and selling alkyd resins, but the company decided they were only going to stick to those things that contained silicon, and since his things didn't contain silicon, why, he didn't follow through on them. But he did some work on that, and he continued to work here.
So in the period from 56 to, let's say, 59, you were primarily involved with the radiation work.
Right.
Okay, and then in 59, you then moved into something quite different.
Yes, I did. I moved into silicon. I went to the West Coast because Corning suggested it. Corning had been making the optics for the Falcon missile. The optics that Corning made were pure quartz, but the Hughes Aircraft Company wanted something that gave better transmission than quartz, and they knew one thing that did that was silicon itself. So I went out to talk to Hughes about this, and they said, well, yes, they would like to do that, and they knew of a man who was making the raw silicon for these optics, and the only thing was that he was such a small operator that they didn't trust him, and if we would go up and see what he was doing and maybe take some of those ideas back and we could develop it, why, they'd be interested. So I was only there for one day, and we went right up to San Francisco, and I met Dean Napick in Palo Alto. Now, Dean Napick was sort of a throwback. The men from Bell Labs who had invented the transistor, one of them was Shockley Bratton, and I've forgotten the other fellow's name now. But Shockley went to the West Coast, it must have been late 40s, and he started up a laboratory for the development of the transistors and silicon devices, and Napick was included in that group, but there were others, because from that group various spin-offs came about, and from his group came Fairchild Semiconductor and several other groups, and I haven't seen the hierarchy of this, but a few years ago, the chart and the hierarchy of this was a really complex thing, because somebody would leave somebody and start a new company, and it was just wild. People were making money hand over fist, just leaving companies and starting other companies. But Dean Napick had been in this Shockley laboratory and had learned enough about silicon crystal growing, so he started to make a crystal grower of his own, and it was designed to grow big crystals, although he never actually grew a big single crystal. Most of his were polycrystalline material. So when I went to see him, he showed me his crystal grower and told me all about silicon. And I spent, I'd say, about 4 hours with him all together. And he so filled me up with silicon technology that on the way back on the airplane from California, I wrote continuously for 5 hours in order to have a report to give Dr. Collings when I got back. And I gave the report in his office. Couldn't believe that I'd learned all that much, but this all just poured out. It was just, well, the upshot of it was we tried to get in the business of making these crystals, and we made a deal with Napick to build us a crystal grower, and we sent a man out there to work with him and get a crystal. By the time we got crystals made and had Perkin-Elmer grind out some optics and took them back to Hughes had already developed another method, a heat-forming method, a casting method. And so we never went ahead with that process. In fact, we got the crystal grower here and grew a couple crystals and pretty much junked the operation. We decided against that. But at that point, Dr. Collings put me in charge of whatever we were going to do in silicon. And Shaler had been in contact with Westinghouse, and they had wanted us to take a so-called Siemens Westinghouse license. And so the upshot of that was we did take a Siemens Westinghouse license, and in May of 59, four of us went to Germany to see this, and they gave us a very good story. We went to Nuremberg and a little town in Pretzfeld near there, and we went to West Berlin and saw operations there. By the time we came back, we had a pretty good idea of what they did and how they did it, and so we finally did sign a Siemens license and went on from there. We started operations. Dr. Collings thought we ought to have a clean area, and we feel that was important too. So they bought about 600 acres down south of us at a place called Hemlock, about 15 miles south of Midland, and it was in the woods. One other thing, we wanted to be far enough away from road traffic, because we had tried to grow some crystal inside the plant down here, and the traffic on the road would cause the vibration of the melt and wouldn't be good for the crystal growth. So we bought this chunk of property down there, and in the spring of 60, we put up a pilot plant down there, a small concrete building, and as the equipment from Germany started arriving, we put it in there and operated out of there for a year while they were finishing up the main plant. And so by May of 61, we finally moved into the full plant, and we began operations, and that was not a straightforward thing, but it grew rapidly. There was always a terrific challenge in it, because I can remember developing business plans and taking them in, and two or three months later I'd have to go into the Dow Corning management and say, you know, the price of silicon now is below what we forecast for the end of the year. What can we do? So we had to revise our business plan time and time again because of the rapid drop in silicon prices. But we did do some very interesting work down there and developed some unique ways of selling silicon. Silicon was sold before in just chunks or so we finally sold it in crucible size charges. It would fit directly in a crucible and could be used to grow a specific size crystal. In those days we were talking about crucible charges that were a couple of inches in diameter or so, but the last crucible charges that I saw we were selling were 6.5 inches or so. And finally they got so big that the pressure on the crucible at that one was too much. It would break the crucible. So we finally had to break it up into chunks. And now they don't do it that way at all. They sell the whole rod and they just take it right out of the reactor and package it up in plastic, send it right off to the company. And the grower then breaks it up himself. We were very much concerned about impurities, and oh my, we ran gremlins all over the plant trying to find them at times.